Penguin Random House Audio presents Token Supremacy, The Art of Finance, The Finance of Art, and the Great Crypto Crash of 2022 by Zachary Small. Read for you by Gabby Beans. For Seth and Ozymandias. Enchanted by its rigor, humanity forgets over and over again that it is a rigor of chess masters, not of angels. Jorge Luis Borges. Introduction. The Renaissance died 400 years ago in the glittering light of the Dutch Golden Age, as the Netherlands became the economic and cultural center of Europe, an epoch defined by the paintings of Michelangelo, the philosophies of Montaigne, and the scientific discoveries of Copernicus had run its course by the late 1630s, when Amsterdam added a booming art market to its merchant empire. The Dutch Republic's population never exceeded 2 million people, but something like 10 million paintings were produced during the Golden Age. Even butchers collected paintings, which hung in their market stalls above the meat. But symbols of a flourishing economy gilded a wicked reality. Plague ravaged the Netherlands between 1635 and 1636, with cities losing 20% of their populations. Death brought new purpose to the living, and survivors found comfort in the beauty that came with money. The tulip market developed alongside the art market to satisfy that demand for beauty. However, the flower merchants were better salespeople than the visual artists, emphasizing the speculative potential of the tulip bulb. The uncertainty of the bulb's viability and the randomness of reward when it bloomed became an addictive draw for buyers. Soon, merchants were recommending that collectors purchase bulbs on contract so they could trade their stock even before receiving any flower shipments. Prices spiked, and even a single bulb could sell for thousands of guilders or dozens of sheep, the equivalent cost of a large townhouse. Demand rose through the beginning of 1637, when buyers were acquiring their bulbs by weight. The reduction of the tulip market into what critics described as pound goods meant that investors no longer required any botanical knowledge to succeed. All anyone needed was a sense of the going rate. It was bad algebra from the start, and the slightest decrease in bulb prices forced the entire economy to collapse, as investors defaulted on loans they had made based on the inflated value of tulips. Everyone from the chimney sweeps to the wealthy noblemen lost their life savings. Priests who had denounced the tulips as symbols of vanity and greed used the market's demise for their fiery sermons. Artists found new subject material, caricaturing the speculators in paintings where they appeared as ill-mannered monkeys, destroying palatial estates cluttered with their wilting bouquets. Jan Brueghel the Younger's 1640 interpretation of the fiasco graces the cover of this book. Rationalism prevailed over the escapism of tulip mania, disproving the theory that one could attach value to seemingly valueless objects, though history hasn't stopped succeeding generations from retesting the hypothesis. From the prospectors of the 1848 California gold rush to the computer whizzes behind the 2000.com crash, the promise of infinite gains from the uncertainty of financial speculation has driven the decision-making of powerful men and women whose failures often sprout the next generation of successes. These stories suggest that the importance of market bubbles has less to do with the economics of idiocy and more to do with the social structures that encourage their growth. The hallmark of tulip mania reappeared only a few years ago with the arrival of NFTs. Non-fungible tokens were a relatively simple technology for tracking ownership of digital assets, but financial speculation had transformed them into a $40 billion industry, anchoring the broader $3 trillion market for cryptocurrencies in the prestigious art world. That relationship between cultural producers and the market seemed to afford NFTs another layer of value. But how special were these digital tulips? And what made them such powerful economic tools? Years earlier, a relatively small collection of digital artists and tech entrepreneurs had conspired to improve the internet through blockchain technology. The original pitch was simple. NFTs could solve two fundamental problems with the online economy by recording transactions for digital goods and providing creators with access to resale royalties. Then it somehow morphed into an ideology of cultural renaissance and economic revolt. NFTs were about creating a decentralized society where users traded digital artworks like money, and about bankrupting the toxic business model of social media platforms that siphoned their personal data for profit. And, finally, NFTs reached their apotheosis as icons of an inscrutable religion. This last metamorphosis into babble, investors ranting online about how their digital collectibles had transformed them into human gods, demonstrated the full psychological tilt of speculation. Had the 21st century simply replaced tulip bulbs with another arbitrary form of investment? Most critics said yes. It seemed obvious that the cartoons of bored apes and pixelated punks that were being traded for millions of dollars would soon wilt like the Dutch flowers. However, closer inspection revealed an elaborate financial system being developed through NFTs, which sought to capture the volatility of tulip mania, combine it with the economic potential of the art market, and create a perpetual money machine. It was a moonshot gamble by the millennials who dominated the digital world, looking to recapture a sense of the financial security that had disappeared in the years following the 2008 financial crisis when they were young. A similar anxiety pervaded the Amsterdam of tulip mania, where an artist named Rembrandt Harmansen van Rijn walked among the wretched of Holland. He carried around his copper plate like a sketchbook, tracing the anxious anatomies of Amsterdam's vagrants with baggy clothes and hunched backs. His fortunes rose alongside the tulips, which marked the beginning of his own personal renaissance, when he could afford to purchase a family home in the city center. Rembrandt etched himself into the costume of beggars, replacing their features with his own unmistakably broad nose and frizzy hair. Those self-portraits seemed to foreshadow his later years of financial ruin, and history would remember this older version of the painter, who defaulted on his mortgage payments and brought ruin upon himself. Through his fascination with poverty, Rembrandt was summoning a pathology that has been stubbornly ingrained in the cultural subconscious for centuries. He was drawing upon the paradoxical realities of pursuing an artistic life in the 17th century, which, as today, required artists to operate between the extremities of wealth and poverty. The decisions of a few powerful patrons could make or break careers, and the debt required to become a certified, professional artist was immense. That made an artist like Rembrandt, someone unwilling to ingratiate himself to clients, often declining their requests for better chins and bigger hands, especially vulnerable to the pitfalls of pursuing creative genius. Cruelty bookended his career, separated by midlife accomplishments like a 1642 painting, The Night Watch, which featured members of a civic militia responsible for patrolling Amsterdam streets, a group that likely cleared the alleyways and canals of the beggars whom the artist once sketched. Rembrandt shot into the stratosphere of European society after the Night Watch. He could have lived comfortably on the acclaim and commissions, but the artist had a money problem. Rembrandt liked spending his wealth on rarities, even bidding on his own paintings. A court arrangement in 1656 helped him narrowly avoid bankruptcy. Though he needed to sell most of his paintings and antiquities, his house and printing press. The Amsterdam Painters Guild was so embarrassed by the famous artist's dissolution that they instituted a new rule. Nobody in Rembrandt's financial circumstances could trade as a painter. Message received. Starving artists are unwelcome, because their financial ruin could delegitimize the market. Rembrandt only stumbled after this decree, struggling in the 1660s to hold on to commissions while his romantic partner and son died. Before the end of the decade, he too had passed away and was buried in an unmarked church grave. We love Rembrandt because of his painful story, Auctioneers are quick to mention his tortured life when pitching his...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?